Okay, now, so welcome to today's compiler construction, this time with audio, yay. Last time we've been talking about attribute grammar systems as a tool for implementing semantic analysis, which would give us, some way of relating certain syntactic elements with their context, with the help of, semantic equations that would specify how information flows within a syntax tree. So now we're going to continue with applications for this toolkit. And first of all, we're going to start with the so-called declaration use analysis. So this is an application of attribute grammars. So the general setting is, for example, in a syntax code, is in a part of code that you see over here. This Java code that has a few variables declared and a few expressions, statements, and all that. And what you see there is that there is a variable name given, capital A, which is given again to another variable in there, and this is perfectly legal code. Turns out that that you can't really see at a particular use of the variable, for example over here where you just write the content of A, or where you write something into the variable A, you if you just look locally at that particular statement, you can't really decide which of the declarations is to which declaration this use of the variable is actually referring. For that, you need some kind of context in which the variable occurs. So why does that even matter? Well, the problem is that for each of these declarations, you might want to keep a different amount and different amount of memory. For example, one of the declarations has declared a larger type for that particular variable as the other. So you're actually interested that the type of access that you do on this variable actually works on some kind of defined memory for that thing. Also, you might want to disambiguate between these spots, because there's the concept of shadowing, where one variable name shadows another one. So particularly the variable declaration that has been performed in the inner block over here, in this inner scope, shadows the declaration from the outer block, which means that as long as you you are using this variable name within that block, you will refer to a declaration over here, while as when you exit the block and continue the parent block, like this one, a use of the variable name A will then fall back to the formerly shadowed version of the name and refer to this one. So what you ideally would like to have is some kind of binding of the usage of a variable to its declaration. So So that's what is a common problem in generating code for high-level languages. In this area, you speak of the scope of a particular variable when you refer to the area in which the variable is bound to that particular declaration. So the declaration over here opens a scope that ranges like this for the outer declaration of A, while there is an inner scope for another declaration of A. So you need some way of somehow managing the particular scopes and the nesting of scopes for these types of variables. So, well, you see that since they can be nested, this might turn out to be quite nasty. So, what you need to do is to want to resolve the identifiers into, well, in the end, you want to access the memory that they refer to, and for that you need some way of quickly associating a certain identity with that particular variable. Thus, somehow you want to assign them some kind of integer and look their definition up with that particular integer. And furthermore, with this integer, then you want to look up the declaration of that particular thing. So these are the ideas. When you pass the code, you want to translate each variable into an integer code with which you can then look up the declaration. So that would be the plan. So in order to do that, you need certain prerequisites. So usually what you will do is you will give kind of with each new variable name that you encounter, you will generate a new integer ID for those, so that you'll produce a sequence of numbers that you associate with variable names, and for each of these numbers you want to look up what their current declaration is in your code. So what you need for the first part, for this mapping of names to integers, is some kind of function like a hash table that stores the integer that you want to assign your variable name program-wide. And that is usually done with a pretty straightforward idea. We have some kind of function where in which you put the string, and with that you perform a lookup in your internal hash table data structure for that particular string, whether it's already registered as a key or not. If it's not registered as a key, what you then do is you add the mapping from the string to currently lowest not assigned number into your hash table, and then increase the current counter of for new strings to register, and then terminate with that. Otherwise, you just want to return the number that you have entered for that particular string. So that is usually what you would do there. So S is your internal management data structure, which will turn out to be a hash table from strings to integers. So this thing, this is usually used in context of altering the data structure from before. So with that, you in context of maps, for example, you add and or overwrite depending on what is on the left hand side with the right hand side. So you add the mapping from the word to count into the hash table given by S, and that is what you take as a new hash table. in count, you manage the lowest number that is yet not given to a string as its ID. So it's just an ID counter that you keep. So you start with zero or something, give it to your first string that you encounter, increase it by one, wait for the next one, and so on. So you just get increasing numbers to, to be IDs for strings. So with that, you go away from just plain strings and can handle numbers furthermore. For that to work out, you need some way of hashing strings. What does that mean? Well, you need some kind of function that turns your string into a number that can be used as an index for an array, for example. So that is usually done provided by a hash function. This hash function does not directly give you the actual index used or the actual ID for the string, but is there to point to in the actual slot in the array where you find the ID for the string afterwards. So don't confuse them with each other. So with this hash function, you need certain properties in order to use, because usually in these hash tables you go for runtime speed, for example. So the hash function needs to be quite cheap to compute. And the other property that you ideally want is that your hash function should distribute the words for which you use as keys equally over the available slots, so that you in the end can quickly navigate to them and not have to search in a long linear list for your names. So unluckily, these two design goals are quite contrary to each other. So an equal distribution is usually not that cheap to compute. But, that depends on your actual input set. So that is completely on you, what you actually prefer in these areas. So two quite straightforward implementations for that would be applicable to kind of generic lists of things, particularly for things that are somewhat related to numbers. For example, strings, where each of the characters is somehow related to its ASCII or UTF code or whatever you might want to use as numerical representation of that. And, well, for example, for the cheap-to-compute solution, you would take something like the sum of the first and the last letter of your string and distribute it over the m available slots in your array by just computing the modulo operation on that. So that would be a quite quick solution to do that. However, this of course means that the stress is lying on the very first and the very last letter of your sequence or string, and this might not be ideal depending on your actual input set. If you need something more clever and more equally distributed, you might take into account more and more and more probes in your sequence, like taking the very middle character and even more like that. With the other extreme, taking all the available characters into account in a particular fashion, particularly the one that you see over here, where each of the letters of the string actually take part in computing the hash value by summing them up with prime number radix, that's just pretty similar as you do your number system with digits. You have a certain radix with which you just determine the positions within your final number, and that's taken by the prime number p here, and apart from that you just multiply and add repeatedly, thus creating a very large number, which you can then take for performing your modulo operation. So this is kind of the other extreme of hashing, taking all the occurring sequence members into account. It completely depends on your key set, whatever works for you. What you don't need in any way to for this thing is that hash values need to be unique. This is something that is not strictly necessary. So if you have few hash function collisions with your example set, that's not a big deal, except if all of your hash values collide, then you should probably think about switching to something else. So what you usually do in these cases is that you don't manage actual entries in your hash tables, but you but what you do is you usually manage lists of entries in your hash table, and then have a linear search in these lists for the actual value. That is the other thing. You need enough space, of course. If you completely overload your mini hash table with a large number of mappings, then you're not going to succeed in any way. So it needs to be large enough. So with that, you can average your access via insert and lookup to something in the dimension of a constant, but you might want to tweak the details of your implementation a little bit, depending on, well, of course, the size of your hash table, the hash function itself, and yeah, that's probably pretty much it. As an example, we can, of course, do this kind of procedure on arbitrary texts, replacing words with strings, words with integer numbers. For example, in this input, you could replace each of these words with integers with this principle, like, well, counting for each new occurrence of a variable, some ID number, like Peter would be assigned a 0, Piper 1, Pick 2, A 3, Pick 4 of 5, 6, 7, 8, and then it repeats again, thus mapping to already former used ID, like Peter would be 0, Piper 1, Pick 2, A 3, Pick 4 of 5, Pickle 6, Peppers, whereas 9, the is, I think, also new. Peck was already there, like 4. Off was already there. 5, pickled. 6, peppers. 7, Peter was 0. Piper 1, and picked 2. So that is what this thing gives you. It just replaces each exact match of a particular string with its unique ID. So this does is not yet the actual determination of a variable and its scope, but instead just a mapping to unique IDs. So it's kind of a preparatory transformation that you do. So yeah, there is again the output for that, and with that, you get the following data structures. So there's the actual mapping between the numbers and the words, and also the created hash table if you instantiate your hash table with a size of 7 and use just first and last letter of your key. So that's usually how you do this mapping to numbers. So when you have done that, you can continue with the actual reference of uses to declarations, and that is something that is done usually with the help of so-called symbol tables. So what you do for that is that you usually check for the correct usage of variables with respect to, well, you only want to find a usage of a variable when there has already been a declaration of that variable, at least in most of the languages. And you also want to refer to the declaration that was the most recent with respect to your actual scope nesting. So that is something that is perfectly suited for a typical attribute grammar-based run through the syntax tree, particularly with an L-attributed grammar, so, because you usually descend into the leftmost parts of your syntax tree, finding a declaration of a variable, consider that to be valid for the current scope, and transport this along the L-attributed run or the L run through your program until you meet the next closing bracket for your scope. And during the time from the declaration to the next closing of the scope, you would consider this declaration to be visible for variables, and if a variable turns out to speak of the same variable name, you would associate them with each other. And you can, during your run through the syntax tree, you can put shortcuts into your syntax tree, linking from the usage of the variable to its declaration. So in order to do that with working code, you would manage different notions of variables on a so-called on a stack, where you put the currently visible declaration of the variable on. And, well, if you encounter a new declaration, you don't throw away your collected information about former declarations of that particular variable, but you keep it on the stack and add the new one on there. And as soon as this runs out of scope, you remove it again from your stack and work with the former version of the declaration. So, whenever we, during this run, encounter then that there's an occurrence of the variable in usage fashion, then we just check for the top of the stack for the currently visible declaration. If you find one, then it's good. We take that as our declaration. If you find none, well, we have found or uncovered a usage of a variable that has not been declared before. And depending on the semantics of the programming language, this will then either turn into a declaration itself for some languages. For other languages, this is an absolute don't, and this will lead to an actual error. So, depending on the semantics of your program language, you will react accordingly in that situation. So, as an example for our C-like languages, we can assume something like this over here, where we have program code starting with an opening bracket. And usually in these C-like languages, we always start with declarations of variables in the beginning of a scope. So, that's what's done over here. Also, I've printed these boxes where the mappings from variable names to actual IDs are already pre-given. So that is what we get from an initial run through the program. And, well, what happens now if we analyze for definition use in that context? Well, we will enter definition sites for each of the variables. So, for example, over here, we will start by having seen that there's a declaration of A and B. So we will enter in our stack, well, this stack for each of these variables over here, the locations for each of those. So that's location V and W. I spare you the actual coordinates in terms of rows and columns for these abstracted V and W things. You know what I mean? Usually you would really, well, either have a link to your actual data structure representing this declaration statement or have some other meaningful way. In this case, we will remain abstract to just remain like that. Well, and then when we pass this assignment, B gets assigned 5. What we will do is we will look up in our current state of declarations for the variable name B, and we'll find that our stack will point to declaration V. So this B gets linked to this B over there. After we pass the condition where we encounter another occurrence of B, which is linked to this declaration over here, we will find another scope is created, and within that scope we will find another declaration, now with abstract locations X and Y, and we get a new declaration for C and a declaration for A. So what happens with respect to before is that for C we will get a new entry. Oh, no. Like this one. And A also is defined there, so we don't really look at what is there. We just push another location on the pushdown for A and find that this is now the new declaration for that. With that, we go on through the program, find another instance of A over here, and we blindly just check for the topmost declaration on the stack for A and see, well, this is a location X. Location X is referring to this one over here, so we will create a link to this one. And so on with C. C is also looked up here to Y, so this will be that particular thing. There's another A, which gets a link to this A. B, well, B is looked up over here, and this tells us we have to look it up in W, which is a pointer to this one over here. And that way we can find the correct implementation of that. So C, again, is the one over here. Now, the thing is that in our progress through the program, we have now reached this point over here, which is the first time that we actually close the some scope. So we will need to somehow revert the changes that we have done to the simple table. So what we ideally would want is that the simple table reverts back to its original state, and well, since we enter another new scope with a new declaration, we will alter the original version again with some C. The question is now, how do we actually find out which of the entries we are supposed to pop from the pushdown, or from the stack? So, yeah, that's actually a valid question. In a language like the traditional NCC, you have only one chance to really come up with new declarations, which is right at the beginning of the block. So usually if you are visiting a certain block in your visitor, you have direct access to all the declarations that have been performed in that block by looking up the declaration child in the syntax tree of the block, so to say. So for those languages, you're fine. The question is, what do you do for languages like non-ANSI C, like C99 or something, where you are allowed to put your declaration of variables somewhere within the block, or and not directly at the beginning. You would have to scan the whole block for each of the for occurrences of declarations or what? Well, no, what you yeah. I didn't get the exact measurement. So that is the actual idea that you would have to follow in these settings. You would have to introduce markers for... So that would be the marker for entering the very first block from line 2, for example. And then you could just push all the declarations A and B on there. And as soon as you hit the bracket over here, what you would do is you would put another marker on there. A, B, and C was like there, I guess. And the old marker is still there. So it would look like this. So we would each time that you enter a new block, you would put a marker on the push down. So that if you then continue with all the new declarations that you encounter, and then encounter a closing of a block, you can pop the stack until you reach the last marker, and only remove that, and then continue with the old version. So in case you encounter that, you would remove this one, this one, and all the markers. And then continue with, well, the old marker stays untouched because it was not the first marker found. And, well, then you open a new block, of course, so you need to add new markers for this, and it was there because C is directly declared after the opening of the thing, so there, the opening marker had to be put on there before. So that is the way that you would manage these kinds of things. Otherwise, you could not really say which of the variables had been pushed to the stack in that current iteration of the block nesting. So, yeah, that's how we do it. Good. Apart from that, there's nothing new to come. We just then close the thing again, throwing away everything over there, just keeping our original A and B on there. And when we hit the final closing bracket, we would also remove these things. So that is the implementation with the table of stacks. What you get out of that is, this is kind of a simplified syntax tree for the code example from before, with a lot of blocks that carry their declarations and statements with them. And what you particularly want as a result of your analysis is to create these links or back pointers from the usages to their declarations. So that is usually what you create from there. And with this syntax, with this, what was it? With these stacks, you can actually implement that. Another way of dealing with declaration use and type information is another implementation for symbol tables, which is referring to the way that you actually that you manage your current mappings, and instead of keeping a stack for each of the variables, what you would do instead is that you would keep a stack of hash tables where you would look up the value of a found usage of a variable in the topmost symbol table. If you would not find mapping for that, you would continue with the next in line, look it up over there. If you don't find something like there, you you continue on until you reach the bottom of the list, and in that case you know that there has not been any declaration of that variable. With that, you would save the time of pushing frame markers on each of the variables stacks, and instead just generally push a new symbol table as soon as you enter a block, and generally just pop a symbol table as soon as you leave a particular block. If you are reluctant to do something like that due to the idea of having to traverse the complete stack in order to look up whether there is a declaration of your variable or not, what you can do to circumvent that is by cloning the symbol table each time that you, or cloning the topmost symbol table each time that you enter a new block. Thus, you will always be guaranteed to find the declaration for a usage if there exists one, and you can, without any refrains, just throw away the manipulated symbol table after you have left the block, because the original symbol table is still in place. This might also seem a little bit excessive for people who dislike cloning, so there's another optimization you can do there. You can use an implementation where you share the internals of your symbol table. If you implement it in kind of in trees, where you just keep those parts of the symbol table that remain the same and just replace all the parts of the internal tree that actually changes when you do an update on the mapping, and only propagate the new data structure. So this is quite common if you come from, well, functional programming, but that would be kind of the idea to use. So persistent data structures, persistent hash tables, for example, would be the key for that. So that would be, I think, the preferred way to use that. So persistent hash table and a stack as the data structure for the variable that you propagate through on a depth first run through your syntax tree will give you the chances to register declarations of variables and throw them away as soon as you leave their particular scope, and you can look up the declarations at the points of users anytime without a lot of hassle. So that would be the way to do that. In a more practical topic, coming to the concrete example of finding solutions for translating things like C, and also C++, I think. There's the always occurring topic of type definitions. That is a thing that pops up all the time when you talk to people about C and C++, and particularly that the grammars that you find for those things are usually not even context-free, since there is this matter of type definitions, and there's a lot of mumble, and people just say, well, it's not context-free. So, what's the problem with type definitions, and why is it necessary to do some kind of semantic treatment in order to come up with that? So, the problem is that, there's a syntax feature in C with which you can introduce a synonym for a type in type definition. So, you usually do that with a particular keyword, which is the typedef keyword. So, this might look something like this. You have a typedef keyword and then some complicated expression on types, like struct with int x and int epsilon. And then you determine a particular character sequence that shall act as a synonym for the more complicated type expression. So far, so nice and convenient. This also enables you to construct recursive types in a more readable fashion. So that's the example over there, but that's probably nothing new for most of the C programs in the audience. So what is the problem with these types of features? Well, if you look into the grammar that belongs to C, you will see that in the internals, the grammar distinguishes between two notions of tokens. So there's the typedef names and the identifiers. And, if you talk about token classes, you might also talk about how they are lexically defined. And turns out typedef names and identifiers are actually using the exact same pattern for lexical analysis. So how do you actually determine whether a particular piece of input is actually to be classified as an identifier or a typedef name? Well, that happens by the place where the character sequence is actually found. So the context of that particular character sequence. So if this, let's call it identifier, is found in the context of a typedef declaration, then while it is over there, it is considered to be an identifier. But as soon as you reach the next line, the exact same sequence of characters is considered, or has to be considered, to be of token typedef name. Well, that's quite amazing for the lexical and syntactical analysis to deal with that, because that is completely messing with the actual idea that is behind that. It's with that, the lexical analysis is just no function anymore. It's just, depending on the actual context, it has to yield different ideas. So if you look at the relevant C grammar, you will find this, that the declaration, that is also what this typedef thing actually is expecting to have in its declarator an identifier. So that is this point T thing from the line, from the first line. And this one is actually a thing that is expected to be also a declaration, but this time point T is in the part of the declaration specifier which is expected to be a type name. So that is where all the confusion is all about. What is now the actual problem? You could think about, I can solve that pretty easily by communicating a little bit between parser and scanner and just keep a list of all the identifiers that I have seen in my parser at the point of, well, while being in the typedef structure, in a typedef clause, and just mark them as being candidates for type names. The thing is, well, this is quite a nice thing, but you usually end up, your declaration with kind of such a right-hand side over here. So you would react to the to a declaration, particularly a typedef declaration, when you have read that for. And for example, in any parser that has something like look ahead, you will have already acted based upon the next look ahead symbol, which is already this thing over here, which is now, well, what is it now? Is it an identifier or a type name? Since we haven't reacted to the declaration being being there, already giving point T a different meaning, we have already read the look ahead symbol of there and reacted accordingly. Well, this might work out okay, but not necessarily needs to do the right thing. So, well, what can you do in such a situation? You don't, well, altering with the way that the lexical analyzer interprets certain certain lexical patterns is dangerous in the context of having look ahead symbols. So, what can you do to solve that? You can try to fix the look ahead inside the parser. Well, that seems pretty difficult to actually prove correct, and well, also quite depending on the actual structure of your, for example, canonical automaton in LR parsing. So, well, good luck with that. The other idea would be just to add, to be clever, and just add another rule to the grammar, which says, well, type name is essentially an identifier. Well, you can do that, but then you end up with, well, first of all, your parser generator output explodes with shift, reduce, and reduce, reduce conflicts. Why is that? Well, an expression like this one, where you have an identifier in brackets and another identifier is now either, well, you don't even have to look at that. Even that is now a just brackets to give priority to the inner expression. Or this might turn out to be a typecast if the whole thing turns out to be reduced to type name later on. So there's a lot of potential shift or reduce conflicts or reduce conflicts in there. So, well, tough luck with that. I would say you make your grammar ambiguous by adding such a thing. So the actual solution that you can come up with is to register the type name early enough for the system to not break. And what does that mean is, well, the problem arises from making the modification in the internal list of type names when you are there. If you are here instead, you still have your line terminator, your semicolon, available as a look ahead symbol. So if you do the manipulation there, the you will definitely have a semicolon still following, which is not a thing that that overlaps with your type names or identifiers. So this thing will be safe from fiddling with the concept of something being an identifier or a type name. So you need to make sure that the actual change to the list of type names happens a little bit earlier. And, well, you can do that by introducing a particular rule for the type dev production where the declarator will be handled by kind of a sub-production which has its own reduce action which already performs the relevant change to the list of type names. So that is your way out. So, yeah, that is what usually happens in these situations. So, enough now with declarations and uses of variables. Next thing in semantic analysis for us is type checking. So this is another application of attributed grammars or related systems, and has a little bit of different goal than declaration use analysis. It's not about something being declared at all and being associated with the correct declaration. This is now about the correct usage in terms of semantics of a particular variable, and thus the expressions that use these variables. So context is that programming languages, the constructs like variables, functions, and all have a particular fixed type. There's simple types like integer, there's composed types like pointer to something, and even very complicated ones like structs that have fields, like this one over here with its X and Y. Of course, you want to have types to determine how you can optimize your memory in order to store your values in an efficient way, and also you would like to type your things in order to get rid of certain dumb mistakes that lead to runtime errors, like misinterpreting your variable storage, taking an address for a string or something. So yeah, you don't want to have these types of errors, so you usually want the compiler to intervene and try to check as many error scenarios as are actually feasible to perform on your program. So, how does that work in practice? Well, the types are usually given by using expressions on types. So with that you can create composite types. So there's the base types that we have already indicated that there are. So there's integers, characters, floats, void, whatever you would find in your language. Maybe also the type names that we have introduced with type defs. And there's type constructors that can be applied to other types. Like, well, in C there's, for example, structures that you can use or create. So there's a type constructor for structs. There's a type constructor for pointers, like that. You can create arrays. Maybe in some instances of languages you can even specify the size of an array as part of your type. And there's functions that have a signature with a return type and parameter types. And usually you have the return type in front and then the parameter types in the brackets. And, well, there's also other ways of describing types, like this notation over here from functional languages. Well, there's also the one with all arrows all over. So, yeah, that's it's different ways of denoting these kind of constructors. So all of these are used to compose data types in languages. So what is type checking now? Type checking is the thing where you're given a set of type declarations that you have collected in your declaration use analysis, probably, and get given a particular expression where there occur usages of variables from your type declarations. And the question is, can this expression be given a type, and what is the actual type that is given to that particular expression? So it's a twofold thing. Of course, there's like always in computer science, there's this thing of does it work at all, and then what is the particular answer for that? Yeah. That depends on the semantics of the thing that you call the generics there. So there's different notions of how these are implemented in compilers and languages. So it's not the generics out there. That's completely dependent on the language. But this is kind of a... Well, it's usually somehow embedded into type checking of a... of some sort, and it's working more or less well depending on how it is realized in that language. So this can be seen as kind of an extension of the basic type checking, but would happen in the same analysis as this one. So yeah. So in an example, our type declarations might look like this, and we could wonder whether it is possible to give an expression like this one a particular type, and what the actual type of this expression might be. Yeah, and how would you proceed in something like that? Well, usually you would consider the expression to have some kind of syntactical structure, as the one over there. So this expression is already syntactically correct, so it has a particular syntax tree. And this syntax tree can now be used to check for correct typing by, well, you need to traverse the syntax tree, probably from bottom up, because you start at the actual variables and constants in these things, and then propagate the types that you look up for these elements of the expression, and propagate their types along the syntax tree while rewriting the propagated type depending on the node that you pass, and also trying to perform certain sanity checks while passing particular nodes in order to check whether this would actually work. For example, if you pass the array lookup operator like this one over here, you would want to check for one child to be an actual index and the other thing to be an actual pointer type, for example. So only if that is the case, then this is an actually valid array lookup. And only if these assertions are correct, then you would propagate, you would be, for example, able to compute a type for that particular sub-expression and propagate this type to its parent. So, yeah, you would do that based on the rules that you take from a type system, and in type systems you usually get the rules how typing works in form of these implication style rule definitions. So you get implications on the so-called judgments that give you implications on the type that a certain expression has. So in the type environment here, the expression E has the type T. And this is particularly easy for the leaves in the syntax tree. So constants, for example, have without any precondition always evaluate to their particular type depending on their lexicographic class. So you can usually identify whether this thing is kind of an integer or a string or whatever you might have as basic data type or Boolean or something. Then there's variables, and variables can be just looked up in your type environment. So you just query the mapping for an entry for the key of X. So that is what the last chapter was all about. This type environment gives you such a mapping, so you can just simply look them up. So those are the easy things. They don't have any precondition. You can just directly read off the type that they have. Of course, a variable that is not found in the type environment would immediately let the type checking fail, because, well, if there is no entry given, then, well, bad luck. Typing has failed already. Anyway, the more complicated rules then are, well, the ones with the operators. So let's have a look at a little bit more complicated ones. So there's the referentiation and dereferentiation operators. So usually how you read that is you if the type environment for a particular expression evaluates to type T, then a type expression with a referentiation operator would then yield the type pointer to the type that has been determined for E before. So with that, you can determine how the type after the referentiation operator looks like. Dereferentiation works in a similar way. You assume that, as precondition, that in your type environment, an expression E evaluates to a pointer type, then the dereferentiation operator will then be considered to be of type only T without the pointer 2. And so you can continue the list of rules how to construct types out of parts in the following way. For example, there's this array expression. So array indexing from expression E1 and E2 has a type T if the second operand is of type int, for example, and the first operand has type pointer to this set type variable T. So, yeah, with that, we get a type T out of that. Array indexation, it only works on array types, but also not only on pointer types, but also on array types. So you can have another instance of the rules for arrays with array type instead of pointer type. So that is also supported. And I think there's also rules which switch around the operators. So you can have the index in front and the array type as the second operand, but that's probably more of a obscurity than an actual thing that you really want to do. Then there's the rule for struct accesses. So the type for an access to an expression E under the accessor AI is of type TI if there exists a struct as type for expression E, where the accessor AI yields type TI. So, well, that's what you would expect from an access to a struct type. The resulting type is the type of the accessor for that particular struct. So, well, that's what you usually expect there. Then there's the application of functions. So, the type for a function application is, well, there's the precondition that the function type is actually the type of a function, so it must be declared as a function, and the resulting type of the whole thing is the return type from here. If all the types of the parameters E1 to EM correspond to the types from the parameters in the definition. So if all that works together, then the type checking is fine, and the resulting type is the one from the type of the function variable. Then there's the rule for arbitrary operators. I've put box in there because you could have either arithmetic expression or arithmetic operator that you want, like summing up or subtraction, or also something like assignment. So assignment is also a particular operator in that context. So what you usually get with these things is that for that to be successfully type checked, the both operands E1 and E2 need for now the same type each of them need the same type. And then the resulting type will also be of that particular type. So there's a type variable T which needs to be the same for each of those. This might be extended a little bit later on in the lecture. So, yeah. Then there's the explicit cast with a cast expression where there's a type expression directly mentioned in the expression, and this usually results in that particular type if the operand expression E evaluates to a type that can be converted to the type from the typecast expression. And what this can be converted to or is compatible to actually means, well, with the means that we have so far, that is not yet given, but we will talk about that a little bit later on. But in principle, that is the way that type systems work. You get given your rules in terms of these implications, and then you put them to use in your tree. So in the end, you will kind of follow the syntactical structure of your expression and apply the rules along along passing the tree from the leaves to the top. So this will end up in types being given to the intermediate nodes as well, and how that actually works in a kind of a regular way is like you see over here. So usually you would try to find instances of the type rules where the so far variable types are replaced with actual real types from your type environment, and alongside you would perform a lot of checks. So how you would do that is you would take the expression in question and start a kind of implication tree with that. So you start at the bottom of that tree and set up the actual expression for which you want to check the typing. And depending on the syntactical structure of the expression that you use, you start decomposing the expression that you find over here in the implication into the parts, depending on, well, how the syntactical structure of the whole thing is. So, for example, here the dominant node is the multiplication, which fits into the rule for an operator. So that's why the first rule application here is the operator, and it operates on the two operands, which are... Oh, sorry. Didn't look particularly well into the details. That addition is the topmost operation. So that's the operator application. And then there's the two operands over here and this one over here. So you decompose the expression based on the dominant syntax element and try to apply the correct rule for that particular dominant syntax part. So that's the operation, which means that we need, for the operation, we need to have common types between both of the operands. So that's this pink T that is introduced there. Apart from that, this goes on in a recursive way. So we need this expression to be type-checked in a certain way, and, well, this just fits into the rule for constants, and this means that we just have to look up the constant in the type environment, but we will do that a little bit later on. First, there's still well, more complicated expression over here, which needs to be decomposed by its syntactical structure, and this time it's the dereferentiation operator, which means that we apply the rule for dereferentiation here and continue working on its sub-expression. And, well, this is still nothing that that we can easily type check, so we need to continue, but introduce a new a heap for that because I run out of space over here. So this is for the expression from over here. I continue over here with that. So this is now an array indexation, which is that is the dominant part of this expression over here. And this usually consists in left-hand side operand, which will need to be an array type, and the right-hand side operand, which will usually be an integer type. So that is this one over here. And we will continue to decompose. This one is now a function application, so this is the application rule. On, well, this B arrow C is just a rewritten version of dereferentiating B and then struct access, so it's just syntactic sugar. And over here, this F, well, will need to be some kind of function declaration, and the type needs to be the same as the type from over here, so that's why the T is introduced, in order to keep in memory that, or to keep in mind that these need to be the actual same ones. And, well, we still need to continue on with, I think, the red one over here, which can be further further deconstructed into just a dereferentiation and finally a variable. And then with that, we have reached kind of the leaves in our syntax tree of the of the expression. Now we can start with the actual type checking. So first of all, well, this will be the variable rule that we need to type check here, and this just means that we need to look up whether B is in our type environment, and I haven't listed it on that slide, but B was there and had the following piece of art as the type. So this is filled in now over here and will get propagated down the implications now according to the rules that we have set up for these implications. So in the dedifferentiation rule, we will then probably take away the pointer type from the whole thing. In the struct access, we then check whether there is an accessor of type C in the base thing, and there actually is. So we will take its type as the return type, and this is immediately filled into the relevant parts of the type tree over here, instantiating this first T thing with a value, so both of them get actually instantiated. So this means that we now have to look up the value of this variable f, whether it is an actual function type that has a parameter of type struct list pointer, and it actually has. It has a return type of int, which fits perfectly fine into this slot because we had the array access, and this would only work if the expression for the right-hand side operand would actually type as an integer, and well, return type of the function was actually integer, so that is perfectly fine. We can continue with that by looking up the variable name for the A, which yields this nice thing over here. So we can try to marry them, and well. Int pointer array and int as an index works fine together with a return type of int pointer, which fits in there. There's the dereferentiation, which takes away the pointer from this type and instantiates this particular variable with int. We now still have to check whether the constant also evaluates to an int in order for the whole system to work together with each other, and well, it actually does. So 2 is an integer, so here we have another check mark, and the final type for the whole expression then is integer. So that is how the whole system works. You kind of decompose your thing with the rules of the syntax tree alongside creating rule instances, which you then have to try to check whether they actually apply, and get a particular rules how they work, and by applying them you can just check whether all the preconditions are met, and on the way compute types for all the sub expressions and the final complete expression. So that is usually what you do in type checking. So, this, of course, was with the premise that we usually had to check for equality of types in a quite easy way, particularly in the one that ANSI C actually has. Which is the literal equality of the type names. So type names are or types are only considered to be equivalent if their names, modulo of course the type definitions, are actually really the same. So things like declaring a struct as empty in another struct with a different name also is empty, and use them as synonyms for each other is a thing that doesn't really work in something like C. We need to check for actual real literal equality in the system. However, you might yeah well, there's a little bit of details to structs in C. There's, of course, this typedef thing that I said that would be treated special. That is the only exception to the rule of having literal equality between the types. Typedefs are out of the equation here. The thing is that there's a world outside of just ANSI-C where things like equality of types is not only decided on just the literal equivalence of the actual names, but you can also decide to see two types as equals if all the access paths that you can use on the particular types will lead to equal other types. So with that, you get a notion of so-called structural type equality. For example, you could have a structure for lists, like on the left-hand side, where there's an integer field accessed by info and another pointer to a similar list via next, and another list of nominal different type, which also has an accessor of type info, that you can query, and then with next you can access another data structure similar with similar access patterns as the one from before, particularly accessing an integer field via the accessor info and the next field in row with this next thing. So the possible access paths through accessors are somewhat compatible with each other. So both of them allow to use something like base pointer and accessor info, for example, and both of them allow accessor next and on the expression that comes from there, another use of accessor info, and both of them would yield the same base type, for example. So, in C, however, that does not really hold, but there's other languages for which that is okay. So the question is, if we encounter other type systems where something like that is legal, we need to enhance our notion of equality of types. And, well, since these accessor paths can be arbitrarily complicated, the question is, how do we actually determine whether these things are structurally equal or not? And I think that is something that that is probably for next lesson, because 5 minutes will probably not be enough for that. But with that, I think we can already work a lot on type checking and definition use analysis. So that is probably a good point to stop for today and continue next time.